Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, again, I don't have any comments today, and that's probably a good thing because I have a lot I want to say today. But still, please send in some comments related to these last Churchill programs. And we just really like to get them, and we like to read them to everybody out there as well. Well, by the closing days of 1940, Sir Winston Churchill was sure that he had saved his island nation from not only defeat, but from complete loss of freedom at the hands of Adolf Hitler. Now, that is not to say that he believed the war was won. He knew there were still many, many battles to face. And, of course, we know that everything wasn't really decided till 5 years later, in 1945. But yet, it was still clear that victory was, and with the right effort, would be attainable. Now, the thing is, we're going to get back to Paul Johnson for most of today's program, and I want it to be maybe a special program. We're going to work at doing about an hour of programming today. But Paul Johnson, I just wanted to say this, he does a masterful job of bringing the necessary details of this time period in Churchill's life to light. And really, in the last three chapters of his biography, these chapters are really worth detailed time and study. And in other words, what I'm just recommending, don't just pass over them, but really spend some time with them and think about them. And there's a lot that we can apply even to our time period. Now, these last three chapters, it does talk about not only the victory of World War II, but he talks about what happens right after World War II. But they really are an amazing history of a man who was hated, he was mocked, he was ridiculed, and he was ostracized for speaking the truth and doing what was right. And of course, if you've been following Mr. Stephen Fleury on the Trumpet Daily program, you know that he talks about the truth, and that the truth is what's being sacrificed today. And today's media, they're not interested in the truth, they're interested in their own truth. And it's so fascinating to realize this is exactly what was happening with Winston Churchill. Now, for today's program, what I want to do is I'm going to do two things. First, I want to give you some final thoughts on Dunkirk. And then I want to discuss the vital lessons we can learn from Winston Churchill's life. And this really will complete our discussion of Paul Johnson's Churchill. But in order to do the first thing, in other words, give you some final thoughts on Dunkirk, I want to go to the book The Darkest Hour by Anthony McCarten. Now, unless you just really have been out of sync and out of touch with everything in reality, everyone knows that this year the film Darkest Hour, which was directed by Joe Wright, came out. And there was a lot of really great controversy about it. And the thing is, I have seen the movie, and what I'm about to read you is used in one of the scenes, and it's probably, well, it was the most exciting scene for me. There were some things I just knew were wrong in the movie. We're going to talk about that as well. But this is right after, in the book, this is right after the rescue at Dunkirk. And I'm going to read to you from his book, and this is page 252. And so here is what he writes at the bottom of the page. And what we're going to refer to in this passage that we're going to read, it's basically about the speech he gave to the House of Commons after he could make a very positive announcement about Dunkirk. If you remember from our last program, trying to get all the troops out of Dunkirk, he went to the House of Commons, and he said basically he thought he was going to be bringing bad news. There was no way that they could see at that time they could bring all these soldiers and even you know, French and Belgian, you know, soldiers away from Dunkirk or out of, you know, Hitler's hands. And it would have been really a bloody mess had Hitler been able to get to them. But here's what he says. At 3:40 p.m. on June 4th, 1940, the time for practice was over. The evacuation of Dunkirk was complete, and 330,000 troops had been brought miraculously to safety. Now, what he's talking about is the time for practice. What he's talking about there is that Winston Churchill was really a great orator. We know he was a great writer, but he was also a great speechmaker. And we have to realize he made his own speeches. He didn't have a speechwriter like a lot of presidents and world leaders have today. He wrote his own, and he practiced and practiced, and he wrote and rewrote, and he scratched and he changed. And so he was practicing or working on this speech for quite some time. It says, in the packed House of Commons, the Prime Minister stood up. He took four paces to the dispatch box. In all, he would speak for 34 minutes, beginning with a detailed account of the situation in France over the past weeks and moving on to the evacuation of Dunkirk. Now, if you remember the history, what was going on is the French were capitulating. The French were getting ready to surrender. The most, I'd say, powerful army in Europe was flagging, and it was failing. And that was no small thing to Churchill. He knew that if they were going to win the war, they needed a strong French army. McCartan goes on and says, there was no softening of the truth now, and his language was frank, vivid, and shocking. The power of the Nazis was outlined in detail, as were the brave exploits of those who had lost their lives defending the port. He called the evacuation campaign a miracle of deliverance, achieved by valor, by perseverance, by perfect discipline, by faultless service, by resource, by skill, by unconquered fidelity, but stressed, wars are not won by evacuations. And so we know that really Winston Churchill really looked at the whole thing from Dunkirk. It was a miracle of deliverance. It really did save the entire British expeditionary force, and it also saved thousands of French and Belgians as well. So in that sense, it was successful, but they left all of their military gear behind, which just really, essentially, they gave gifts to Hitler and his army. But the point is, it was still a very difficult time. Now, McCartan goes on and says, as Churchill began to warm up, he ratcheted over higher the techniques of rhetoric he knew so well. He started with a question to his audience. Could there have been an objective of greater military importance and significance for the whole purpose of the war than this? And he followed it with another. May it not also be that the cause of civilization itself will be defended by the skill and devotion of a few thousand airmen? He juxtaposed vivid accounts of the conflict with poetic history. And so the thing is, not only was Winston Churchill a genius with his painting, with writing, with his understanding of history, is he really was very much into poetry and understanding poetry, but he took this and he could just motivate and rally the nation with it. Now, here's a quote from the speech, and this speech is in this one important scene in Darkest Hour that I think is the most stunning and exciting scene I've seen in a movie. And it really does bring you to tears when you see it. But he's saying, and you can just imagine, you know, Winston Churchill speaking, you know, in the House of Commons. He states, there had never been, I suppose, in all the world, in all the history of war, such an opportunity for youth. The Knights of the Round Table, the Crusaders, all fall back into the prosaic past. These young men, going forth every morn to guard their native land and all that we stand for, of whom it may be said that when every morning brought a noble chance and every chance brought out a noble knight. Now, that's not only great writing, it's great speaking. And what he's beginning to refer to there is the Battle of Britain. And I think we've discussed it in the past program, that Goering and Hitler believed they could win, you know, Britain with not an invasion, but just from the air and the Luftwaffe. And the point is really because of Winston Churchill, the British Air Force, you know, kept getting stronger and stronger and stronger. And the British airmen, and there were a lot of even American young men that loved to fly planes, came and they participated in the Battle of Britain. Now, the Battle of Britain took a long time to win, but certainly they were very noble. They were just young men. Some of them were just like 18 and 19, early 20s. And here, this is what Winston Churchill says, they were noble knights. Now, that would really rally the English people because they were so used to, you know, the knights, and they were so used to chivalry. They were so used to having a king. And that's just not, well, it's just not as known in the history of America. We're a different people, even though we know that we're brothers, you know, in our history. Let us get back here now to what McCartan says. He spoke of Hitler's plans to invade, but reminded the people that throughout the centuries, Napoleon and other continental tyrants had planned similarly but never succeeded before finally moving into the peroration he had been working on intently. Now, this gets back to the speech. I have myself full confidence that if all do their duty, if nothing is neglected, if the best arrangements are made as they are being made, we shall prove ourselves once again able to defend our island home, to ride out the storm of war, and to outlive the menace of tyranny, if necessary for years, if necessary alone. At any rate, that is what we are going to try to do. That is the resolve of His Majesty's government, every man of them. That is the will of Parliament and the nation. The British Empire and the French Republic, linked together in their cause and in their need, will defend to the death their native soil, aiding each other like good comrades to the utmost of their strength. Even though large tracts of Europe and many old and famous states have fallen or may fall into the grip of the Gestapo and all the odious apparatus of Nazi rule, we shall not flag or fail. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And even if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the New World, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and liberation of the old. Now, that was some speech, and of course, the way I delivered it here on the radio is nothing like the actor in The Darkest Hour showed. Of course, you can still go back and even hear the speech, you know, by Winston Churchill. But our author, McCartan, does say this. He says, the speech was a direct hit. Its power was undeniable, and the response rapturous. Several Labor MPs were in tears. Churchill later said of the great task that had fallen upon him, namely to give voice to the people of Britain, that it was they who had the lion heart, and he merely had the luck to be called upon to give the roar. At this moment, in their darkest hour, the roar had never been louder. And so again, this was just a really a great scene in this movie. He goes on, he said, the defining phrase, fight them on the beaches, was actually a homage to his friend, the former French leader, Georges Clemenceau. Having written several essays on the great man and spent time with him at the Paris Peace Conference, Churchill had adapted a line from a November 1918 speech in which Clemenceau said, I will fight in front of Paris. I will fight in Paris. I will fight behind Paris. It's a sort of hop of invention. Indeed, to arrive at Winston's own, we shall fight. Again, as he did in his blood, toil, tears, and sweat speech, he powerfully employed repetition at the beginning of successive sentences. By saying, we shall fight, he emphasized that he would be with the people at their side every step of the way. And so, again, I've seen the movie. I don't agree with the scene where they show Winston Churchill considering to make a peace pact with Hitler. That never happened. And, you know, it's a sad state of affairs. And essentially, I want to read you just from the epilogue of McCartan here and what he says. Now, he put this in the book. It's in the movie that Winston Churchill was ready, you know, to make a pact with Hitler. And it really did stir up a lot of controversy. And it's really just not true. In fact, after I read this to you, I just have one other statement to make about it. But this is page 259 of the book, and the epilogue is called If the Truth Be Told. And that's the point. He didn't tell the truth. And even Mr. Fleury, Stephen Fleury, in the Trumpet Daily is showing over and over again how the news media isn't even telling the truth about President Trump. And it's a disaster. It's a disaster for our people. And our people are being fed lies. And remember that if you look at Chamberlain and if you look at Halifax, they were feeding lies to the English people, you know, just prior to World War II. They were lulling them to sleep, making them to believe they were okay, when really they were in the gravest danger. Now, here's what Anthony McCartan writes. He says, what Winston Churchill did and what he said and what he eventually decided in the terrifying days of May 1940 changed the fate of Britain and of Europe, as well as his own place in world history. But how he made the right decision after a period of fiery argument, of doubt, of soul-searching, of fear, despair, and vacillation, and how he soon after found the perfect words to explain his thinking and beliefs and feelings to the nation has never, to my mind, been satisfactorily told. And the reason why it hasn't been told, because it's not true. He didn't vacillate. You know, there was probably a period of fiery argument, but he didn't doubt what needed to be done. He knew what needed to be done. He goes on to say, in setting out to tell the story, my aim was to show a bigger, more precarious, more psychologically tenable, and although more human story than has previously been allowed. And really, what he's doing is trying to diminish the strength and the moral character of Winston Churchill. And, of course, we've talked about this in other programs. Stephen Fleury has talked about it on the Trumpet Daily. That's the news media's aim, is to just diminish and, tarnish a good, strong leader who's not afraid to stand up and say what's right. Now, I mean, all of us, I think, know that President Trump has his own personal problems. He has his own weaknesses. But I'll tell you what, he's not afraid to do things or say things that he believes in. And he is doing more good for the America than people realize. And even today, Stephen Fleury talked about how they're criticizing him for what happens with Hurricane Florence, when really he was doing everything right, but they're making it look like he did everything wrong. Now listen to this. He says, my own research conducted while preparing the film Darkest Hour and for this book has convinced me that Winston Churchill seriously entertained the prospect of a peace deal with Hitler in May 1940, as utterly repugnant as that might now seem. And again, it's his own research. And really, I mean, I could really scratch out research and say my own thinking. Now, listen to what he writes here. He says, I am aware that this is an unpopular view, one that puts me at odds with almost all the historians, commentators, and academics far more immersed in this period of history than I can claim to be. That says it all for me. This is Anthony McCartan talking about his own truth, and that is the number one problem in the world today. There's truth, and there's Anthony McCartan's truth. And we have to really go for the truth. The truth is failing. And that's what we have to be so aware of. And when we listen to our news media, when we listen to television, when we read our newspapers, we need to make it a personal goal to really research out the truth. And, you know, that is not what's happening. Okay, so that's my statement on the Darkest Hour film and the book. I don't recommend the book for that reason. And you can get a far, far better view of Winston Churchill and the absolute grave situation of Dunkirk, and then even the Battle of Britain. I mean, there's so many things we could talk about, but really don't have time. But you can get that from the Manchester books. There's other really, really good history books, and even you're getting a better view of everything from Paul Johnson. And so I want to get back into Paul Johnson here, and especially I want to just focus on these last three chapters. And we're not going to be able to give you everything, obviously, but I want you to make sure that you get in there and read it and understand it. So chapter 7 is I think it's a really interesting chapter. So what we're talking about is there's chapter 7 is Glorious Twilight. Then, let's see, then it gets into the epilogue. Let's see. Yeah, so it's chapters 6, 7, and the epilogue, the supreme power and the frustration. So in chapter 7, Paul Johnson does make a statement, and I think it's a really good one. He says, "Did Mr. Churchill save Britain?" And then what he does is he gives us 10 reasons why that answer is yes. And I think it's a fascinating chapter. I think it's something that you could read and reread and reread again and again, and to really get a good view of Winston Churchill and what he did. And of course, I think history shows us that it was right after this, in 1945, the nation voted him out of office again, and yet he had saved the nation. And so when you read this and put it together, it's really the damaging effects of dirty politics. And of course, it's a fight between the labor and the conservatives and the liberals, and that doesn't necessarily mean that the right man is going to be chosen for the job. But as we go through this, I'm going to show you that Winston Churchill, even though he was out of office, he did come back in as prime minister again in the 50s. But that period of time between 1945 and 1950, he spent most of his time writing and wrote some of the most fantastic books that we have access to. But let's just I'm just going to give you 5 of the 10, and I'm not going to give them in necessarily. I'm not going to number them for you the way Johnson does, but I'll still give them to you. The first one that I want to concentrate on is actually the number 2 reason of the 10, the why he saved Britain. And the number 2 is the reason why we know that Winston Churchill saved Britain is, and here's what Johnson writes. This is page 110. It says, the second reason is the concentration of power in Churchill's person with the backing of all parties meant that there was never any practical or constitutional obstacle to the right decisions being taken. In other words, when Winston Churchill not only was prime minister, he also made himself minister of defense. That concentrated all the power in one person. One person was making decisions at the top. Now, the other thing you have to know is that just because he made final decisions does not mean he wasn't getting input. In fact, he was getting a lot of input from people. Johnson goes on to say, he told the king everything and listened to all he said. Within months, George VI had swung right round in his favor and wrote, "I could not possibly have a better prime minister." He also observed all the cabinet procedure rules. Above all, and this is all talking about Winston Churchill, above all, he treated Parliament, especially the House of Commons, with reverence and made it plain he was merely its servant. These were not mere formulae. Insofar as Churchill had a religion, it was the British Constitution, spirit and letter. Parliament was the church in which he worshipped and whose decisions he obeyed. All this balanced and sanctified the huge power he possessed and exercised. Unlike Hitler, he operated from a structure which represented and was seen and felt to represent the nation. He was never a dictator, and the awful example Hitler was, and ever present before him to prevent him from acting like one. And so Winston Churchill got a lot of bad rap that he was a warmonger, that he was like a dictator, and yet that wasn't true. Well, we're going to go ahead and just take a short break now, and then we'll be right back and we'll continue with the lessons we can learn from Churchill's life.
You're listening to Just the Best Literature with Dennis Leib on 101.3 KPCG.
Well, we're back, and if you are just tuning in, we are talking about part of the 10 reasons why Winston Churchill saved Britain. And this is the big question that Paul Johnson asks in Chapter 7. And we already discussed that one of the reasons why Winston was able to save England is because he concentrated all the power into his own person. Now, the next reason why Churchill was really able to save Britain is, and it's kind of a unique thing, is that he was the man for really desperate times. Here's what Paul Johnson says on page 111. He says, third, and this is his number three. It's my number two, and I don't want you to get confused by the numbers. I want you to read the chapter. It says, third, Churchill was personally fortunate in that he took over at a desperate time. The sheer power of the Nazi war machine against which he had warned was now revealed. And remember, it was Chamberlain and it was Halifax that actually hid from the people what was going on in Germany. And, Winston Churchill knew that they were building a new war machine and that Britain was not. I mean, Britain was wanting to, to appease Hitler, but they also were into this pacifism and they didn't want to build their army and they didn't want to build up the Navy or the Air Force. And that was the worst thing they could be doing. He says the worst, as it were, had happened, was happening, or was about to happen. He was able to say in perfect truth, just after he took power, and again, this was May 13th, 1940, and this is a speech that he gave to the House of Commons. I would say to the House, as I said to those who have joined the government, I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. And so it was going to be an amazing feat to overcome, the German army. Johnson goes on, he says, he added in the same speech that his aim was quite simple and clear. Victory at all costs. Victory in spite of all terror. Victory, however long and how hard the road may be. For without victory, there is no survival. Now, again, you take that. From this writing from Paul Johnson, and you compare it with what Anthony McCarten says, and certainly you would have to know that Johnson does not agree with Anthony McCarten. Now, Johnson goes on. He says, the last words were of deadly significance and felt to be so, for Britain was not facing defeat in the sense that it had been defeated in the American War of Independence. It was facing extinction as a free country. Ordinary people were made to feel that. Now, here's how Churchill was just a master at doing this. He said, on Churchill's orders, the national anthems of the Allies were played on the BBC before the 9 p.m. news every Sunday. Now, there were seven Allies. Six of the Allies had already been defeated, occupied, and under the total control of the Gestapo. So what does that tell you? So every night, on Sunday night before you hear the news, You hear, six defeated allies, and the only one that was not defeated yet was who? Well, it was obviously Britain. And so that really, helped to rally the people. So the thing is, it was that time. It was so desperate that really even the king realized that Churchill was the man for the job. He said, soon France joined the losers. Churchill certainly did all his power to save her, paying 5 perilous visits to consult with her disintegrating, scared, and defeatist government and service chiefs. He would not, however, and rightly, go beyond a certain point. He was prepared to offer France a union of the two states, a most imaginative and adventurous idea characteristic of his fertility. He was not willing, however, to comply with their request to send all of Britain's precious fighter squadrons to France in a despairing effort to stem the Nazi blitzkrieg. So, you know, it was very desperate. France was succumbing. And so, but under Churchill, he believed that the only way out of this was to have victory. Now, the next reason why Johnson gives that Churchill saved Britain, why it's him. And again, this is so typical of Winston Churchill. So this is his number 4, but I'm going to call it my 3rd. He said, 4th, Churchill himself began to set a personal example of furious and productive activity at 10 Downing Street. And remember, Winston Churchill was 65 at this time. But that didn't matter. Churchill was now energized. He now had all the power. He was walking with destiny. It says he was 65, but he looked and seemed, was indeed, the embodiment of energy. He worked a 16-hour day. He sought to make everyone else do likewise. In contrast to the lethargic, self-indulgent old Asquith, who he called the bridge player at the wharf, or even Lloyd George, who had a high tea instead of a proper dinner to discuss strategy and went to bed at 9 o'clock, Churchill began to wear his own form of labor-saving uniform, a siren suit easy to put on or take off, in which he could nap if he wanted during long nighttime spells at work. So he was just worked himself and just pushed himself. But that really got everybody else going. And, you know, the people that he worked with, they loved him. And here's what Johnson says here. He says, they all loved him and were proud to work with him. They helped him to turn number 10 into a dynamo. And its reverberations gradually resounded through the entire old-fashioned, lazy, obstructive, and cumbersome government machine until it began to hum too. Churchill's sheer energy and not least his ability to switch it off abruptly when not needed, were central keys to his life, and especially his wartime leadership. And Winston Churchill really was just a dynamic worker, and he just inspired other people to work with him. Okay, the next point, or one of the next points that Johnson makes about why Churchill saved Britain was because of his oratory skills. And he goes on to say here, the 5th factor was Churchill's oratory. It is a curious fact that he switched it on to its full power just as Hitler switched his off. Hitler had been in his time the greatest rabble-rouser of the 20th century. In his successful attempt to destroy Versailles and make Germany a great power again, incidentally ending unemployment, his oratory had been a vital factor in making him the most popular leader in German history. But the Germans, while overwhelmingly behind the campaign against Versailles, had no desire to see Hitler turn Europe into a servile German empire, let alone lead them into World War. When Hitler marched into Prague in March 1939, it was his first unpopular act. Until now, he had ruled mainly by consent. Thereafter, it was by force and fear. Sensing his loss of personal popularity, Hitler ceased to address the Reichstag or make public speeches. By the time Churchill took charge, Hitler had retreated into his various military quarters, mostly underground, rarely appearing and never speaking in public. He became a troglodyte, while Churchill became a world figure, ubiquitous in newspapers and newsreel, whenever Nazi censorship had no control. So Churchill used his great oratory. And then the last point I want to make here is that Winston Churchill had the uncanny ability to always choose the right thing to do. And you know, he kept his priorities always straight and right. Now, this is what Johnson has to say. It says, indeed, this is the 10th point. Churchill had an uncanny gift for getting priorities right. For a statesman in time of war, it is the finest possible virtue. Jock Colville, his personal secretary, said, Churchill's greatest intellectual gift was for picking on essentials and concentrating on them. And, you know, here at the college, we even try and, you know, get our students to focus and to concentrate on the essentials. And that's what we teach them and train them to do. He says, but these essentials were always directed toward the destruction of the enemy. General Pug Ismay, his closest military advisor, noted, he is not a gambler, but never shrinks from taking a calculated risk if the situation so demands. His whole heart and soul are in the battle, and he is an apostle of the offensive. And it's amazing what Winston Churchill, his power of focus. And I think even in his painting, it shows his power of focus. I mean, one thing Johnson continues, says, he made it clear in his memos that no commander would ever be penalized for excess of zeal towards the enemy. This was a huge comfort and safeguard for aggressive generals and encouraged the spirit of adventure. And so we know that he really had an adventurous life himself. He was always into an adventure. But here's one other part of this that I think is very important in terms of the uncanny ability to get priorities right. Listen to this. This is Johnson makes the part of it's kind of the last part of this section on point 10. It says, he hardly ever cherished a grudge or a grievance or nursed enmity in his heart. He remembered to thank people for their help too. Before America entered the war, Churchill made a thrilling broadcast on April 27, 1941, which I remember vividly, saying how important American help was and that it was being provided in increased measure. And so the point is, Churchill devoted all of his precious energy to accomplishing. He didn't devote any energy to being negative or being down or to hold grudges or to hold grievances. I mean, he focused his energy in a positive way to move the nation forward. And oh, how we need to learn that. I mean, this world is just focused on competition and greed and hatred and jealousy and envy and how to get the best of someone else. Churchill didn't live his life that way. And that's why he could just unleash himself to do better things. Okay, so read and study chapter 7. I gave you 5 of the 10. The ones I didn't give you were more military in their approach. But we just really need to understand, all 10 of those. And so be sure you go back and read that and just study it. Now, in the epilogue, and I know my wife is not here with me today, but she said, oh, don't forget to cover these really important points. And we are at fall break here at the college, and so my wife is at home taking care of some things that she needs to take care of. And, of course, the church Feast of Tabernacles is coming. This is our annual fall church conference is coming, and so we'll all be, going off and attending that wonderful family time of year. But in the epilogue, Johnson gives us 5 lessons that we can learn from Winston Churchill. And these are really fascinating. And these are something you need. This is something you need to write down for yourself. I know this year in our sophomore English language literature class, we just finished reading Ben Franklin's autobiography. And now they have a 3-week project to build a bullet journal, to schedule their time, and also to work on elements of character. Well, these would be perfect for that. So here are the 5 lessons that Paul Johnson wants us to take from Winston Churchill's life. This is a paragraph he writes. He said, so Winston Churchill led a full life, and few people are ever likely to equal it. Its amplitude, variety, and success on so many fronts but all can learn from it, especially in five ways. The first lesson is always aim high. Now, all of us know that as a child, Churchill did not receive any positive encouragement from his father. He also got very little from his mother. He was very much aware of his failure at school. But still, when he got into the to Harrow and he got into the army, he always set his aim high. And, you know, he conquered a lot of things. Even as a younger man, he conquered his aversion to math, at least enough to pass and get through. you know, in India, he realized he wasn't very well educated, so he started to educate himself and read books. We even talked to you that even when he married Clemmy, she wasn't very educated in in politics, and yet he helped her develop her own self-education in politics. And so he just emphasized for the English, you know, how to really just aim high. And even all of his things during the war, he just kept saying victory, nothing but victory. That's where we're going for the top. And even in school, remember, he loved the English language, and he really applied himself to grammar and to writing. And so always aim high, and don't settle for second best for yourself. Okay, Johnson goes on and says, lesson number two is there is no substitute for hard work. Now, that was something I was actually, you know, taught as a young man. I know I grew up in the 50s, and so we were encouraged to work. We had to work at home. And but this was like a moral, one of Churchill's moral background is that you know, he would really work hard. Now, he had a unique way of doing it. And we've talked about this, that, you know, Winston Churchill, to conserve his energy, spent the morning working in bed. He would telephone from bed. He would dictate from bed. He would consult from bed. He'd read in bed. But he still was working. Says he also, Johnson saying, he also manifestly enjoyed his leisure activities. For him, another form of hard work to keep himself fit and rested and to enable himself to do his job at the top of his form. And, of course, we all know he rebuilt Chartwell, you know, created lakes and gardens, you know, built environments for swans and fish and animals. But he never evaded hard work itself. And, you know, even taking on and making dangerous decisions, that's the hardest form of work. And, of course, he was good at it. And remember, we just read he worked 16-hour days, so he didn't just lay around. But Johnson goes on to say, no one ever worked harder than Churchill to make himself a master orator or forcing himself to travel long distances, often in acute discomfort and danger, to meet the top statesmen face-to-face where his persuasive charm could work best. He worked hard at everything to the best of his ability, Parliament, administration, geopolitics, geostrategy, writing books, painting, creating an idyllic house and garden, seeing things and, if possible, doing things for himself. Now, you know, that's just a great example, and we need to do that for ourselves. And, of course, one of the things that we have here, we have a great work to do here at the college, a great work to do here at the church, and we're always being encouraged to sink our heart in the work. And, of course, you know, Winston Churchill really sets the example for us. The third lesson we can learn, here's what Churchill teaches us, and here's what Johnson says. He says, third, and in its way most important, Churchill never allowed mistakes, disaster, personal or national, accidents, illnesses, unpopularity, and criticism to get him down. Now, we've covered a lot of those things, but Churchill always worked to, well, work through problems. And, of course, even our namesake, Herbert W. Armstrong, wrote a great little book, The Seven Laws of Success. You could just contact thetrumpet.com. You can get a copy of it free for yourself. But, Herbert W. Armstrong was the same way. These were men out of the same you know, Victorian era. But Winston Churchill wanted to be alive. He wanted to do things. You know, he was never going to let an accident, even that horrible accident that happened to him in New York City, he never let that get him down. He kept writing, kept working. Johnson continues, his powers of recuperation, both in physical illness and in psychological responses to abject failure, were astounding. To be blamed for the dreadful failure and loss of life in the Dardanelles was a terrible burden to carry. Churchill responded by fighting on the Western Front in great discomfort and danger, and then by doing a magnificent job in the Ministry of Munitions. He made a fool of himself over the abdication and was howled down by United House of Commons in one of the most savage scenes of personal humiliation ever recorded, yet he scrambled to his feet and worked his way back. He had courage, the most important of all virtues, and his companion, fortitude. These strengths are inborn, but they can also be cultivated, and Churchill worked on them all his life. So we shouldn't let any of the mistakes we make or the problems we face, we shouldn't let those things get us down. Now, fourth, Johnson says, Churchill wasted an extraordinarily small amount of his time and emotional energy on the meanness of life. And what he means there is Churchill didn't devote any energy or very little energy to hatred. Churchill was not into recrimination, shifting the blame onto others, malice, revenge-seeking, dirty tricks, spreading rumors, harboring grudges, waging vendettas. Having fought hard, Johnson says, he washed his hands and went on to the next contest. It is one reason for his success. There is nothing more draining and exhausting than hatred. And that's a lesson we all need to learn. He said, malice is bad for the judgment. Churchill loved to forgive and make up. His treatment of Baldwin and Chamberlain after he became prime minister is an object lesson in sublime magnanimity. That's just amazing. Johnson continued, nothing gave him more pleasure than to replace enmity with friendship, not least with the Germans. Now, here's point number five, and this is probably the most important one of all. The final lesson we can learn from Churchill is the absence of hatred leaves plenty of room for joy. Now, Churchill really did have joy in his life. Now, Johnson goes on to say, his face could light up in the most extraordinarily attractive way as it became suffused with pleasure at an unexpected and welcome event. Witness that delightful moment at number 10 when Baldwin gave him the exchequer. Joy was a frequent visitor to Churchill's psyche, banishing boredom, despair, discomfort, and pain. He liked to share his joy and give joy. It must never be forgotten that Churchill was happy with people. He insisted that the gates of Chartwell should always be left open so that the people of Westerham were encouraged to come in and enjoy the garden. He got on well with nearly everyone who served him or worked with him, whatever their degree. Being more than half American, he was never class conscious. When an old man, his bow to the young queen was a work of art, slow, dignified, humble, and low. But he was bowing to tradition and history more than to rank. He showed the people a love of jokes and was to them a source of many. No great leader was ever laughed at or with more than Churchill. He loved to make jokes and contrived to invent a large number in his long life. He collected and told jokes, too. He liked to sing. Beaverbrook said he did not sing in tune, but he sang with energy and enthusiasm. And so let me just repeat these lessons. The five lessons. Always aim high. Number two, there's no substitute for hard work. Three, never let tough things get you down. Four, stay away from hatred toward others. And five, leave plenty of room in your life for joy. So those are the things that we could really learn from Churchill. And I'll give you just one more. There's a sixth, and this is my own thoughts. If time, keep a journal for your life. And if you look at page 167, I'm not going to turn there, but we know more about Churchill's life because he kept records. He and his wife kept letters. He kept a journal. Your life is important. you deserve to keep a journal too, because you never know who can learn from the lessons in your life. Well, that's all the time we have for today's program. Next time, we'll begin our discussion of George Washington, Founding Father. That's also by Paul Johnson. Remember, our third and final book in this series is Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. You can find both books on Amazon. You can find used copies of the books at abebooks.com. Of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl at pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And remember, you can leave me a comment at Facebook. So, until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. Streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.